Welcome to One True Podcast. My name is Mark Chirino, alongside Michael Von Cannon. In his memoir, A Movable Feast, Ernest Hemingway wrote, "All you have to do is write one true sentence. Write the truest sentence that you know." So finally, I would write one true sentence and then go on from there. In that same spirit of honesty, creativity, and curiosity, One True Podcast explores all things related to Ernest Hemingway, his life, his work, and his world. Today's show continues our celebration of the centenary of the Paris in our time by reading the 18 sketches together. And Michael, today we are up to chapter 3.
That's absolutely right, Mark. We're almost a sixth of the way there.
I didn't look at it that way. We are changing settings. We're continuing with similar themes. So I really look forward, Michael, to today's discussion. But before we get into it, why don't we listen to the great Stacy Keach reading our chapter for today via the great Simon & Schuster audiobook collection, The Short Stories.
Chapter 3. Minarets stuck up in the rain out of Adrianople across the mudflats. The carts were jammed for 30 miles along the Karagash Road. Water buffalo and cattle were hauling carts through the mud. No end and no beginning. Just carts loaded with everything they owned. The old men and women, soaked through, walked along, keeping the cattle moving. The Maritsa was running yellow almost up to the bridge. Carts were jammed solid on the bridge with camels bobbing along through them. Greek cavalry herded along the procession. Women and kids were in the carts, crouched with mattresses, mirrors, sewing machines, bundles. There was a woman having a kid with a young girl holding a blanket over her and crying. Scared sick looking at it. It rained all through the evacuation.
And there he is, Stacy Keach. What a great rendition of this chapter. Michael, so you were mentioning like, okay, so we're through chapter 3. We are a sixth of the way through. We have the Battle of the Champagne. We have the bullfighting. And now we have the evacuation in the Greco-Turkish War. It's our job to kind of assimilate all of this together. So how does chapter 3 continue what we've been talking about, and how does it depart from it?
Sure. It departs from it in one sense, like you've just discussed, by being in a completely different setting. You know, in some ways it brings together two things, though, that we've been talking about. One is it's about the war, but it's also about individuals who are non-combatants. Mm. These are refugees or evacuees. And so with the past few vignettes, you know, I'm thinking about our discussion the last time about bullfighting, what it means to be a spectator looking at a bullfight, how bullfighting is connected to warfare. We've been thinking about what is war like, how all of these vignettes that are about violence are somehow connected to each other. I think those are some of the strains that are connecting these three together here. I know we're going to be looking at a few more things. Certainly, the really important images that are showing up here, how Hemingway is just remarkable in the way that he wants to almost create some static images, these moments that just stand still, that are almost eternal in their own way. They're static and powerful in that way. But those are just some of the ways that I can see how these are connected.
Yeah, when we had Heraclea Zengos on One True Podcast to talk about On the Quay at Smyrna, we remarked that Hemingway is so associated with World War One, and if not World War One, then the Spanish Civil War, and if not the Spanish Civil War, then World War Two. But Heraclea made the case that the Greco-Turkish War, as an early experience, was actually a defining one, and this is a setting that Hemingway returns to. He talks about it in The Snows of Kilimanjaro, of course, in On the Quay at Smyrna. Mm. And in our 18 discussions of these 18 chapters, he's going to return to this more than once. So maybe we could even start by talking about Hemingway's actual experiences and the journalism that came from that, and then how that feeds into this sketch. What do we know about what Hemingway actually did at the Greco-Turkish War? What were his actual experiences?
Yeah, you know, one thing we might want to just remark on is the fact that, you know, prior to this experience, he is with Hadley and a few other individuals, I believe in Germany. And then he's going to get the notice, the call, so to speak, from John Bone and the Toronto Star telling him, you know, there is something going on. Over in this area, after months of a standoff, there's this offensive. Turkey's taking this eastern Thrace, this region. And so, you know, it's really interesting looking back at some of the letters and seeing September 26, 1922, he's writing to Howell Jenkins and saying, you know, I've just taken the Simplon Orient and I'm traveling over to Constantinople. And what's really interesting to me is we think he's going there to actually see an offensive, to see the Greco-Turkish War, and what he really encounters, because of what occurs in, you know, around mid-October, this armistice, that's being signed, is he's really going to encounter this kind of refugee crisis, this evacuation, hundreds of thousands of individuals being evacuated. And in terms of what you're asking at the beginning, what did Hemingway do? You know, we can get into some of the journalistic accounts, because if Hemingway's good at nothing else, he's really good at kind of placing us there and placing himself there. He's kind of metafictional in some of this early journalism where he talks about what he did to kind of get the story. And there's one of them, refugees from Thrace. He'll go through it and he'll talk about the soldiers that he encountered, places he stayed, movie men that stayed there with him as he's trying to get the story. But the other thing he did that's just really interesting to know is he's kind of double dipping in these stories, right? At the same time that he's writing for the Toronto Star, he's also writing some stories under a different name, as John Hadley, I think. And he's writing for the International, the news service, the INS.
And he gets caught. It was a harebrained scheme that gets caught.
Yeah. Well, he tells John Bone that he had to send these messages through the INS, but that the language of it is that he wasn't sending them to be published in that way, but they actually in essence stole them from him, which is not true at all. But he did get caught.
The one thing that I wanted to think about when we're comparing, let's say, Hemingway's journalism and the sketch that ended up in our time. In the article, Refugees from Thrace, which was published by the Toronto Daily Star, November 14th, 1922, Hemingway writes, "I walked 5 miles with the refugee procession along the road." I think this is still in question about whether he actually did join the procession for 5 miles, or if he just got a ride with that film crew. And he's like, he looked at it, and this was equal parts imagination and reporting. So let's just test that 5 miles. How long do you think he walked in that procession?
Well, you know, it's really interesting, because even when he's talking about the film crew, and I would love to get into that moment at some point, but just to kind of paraphrase it, even when he's talking about the film crew, they're really discussing how do you fictionalize? How do you exaggerate certain moments of, in this case, a newsreel about a village burning, making it look like an entire town is burning? And so that whole moment is about kind of the quasi fabrication of what should be actual authentic news. You know, he also talks about cars, other kinds of automobiles, the Fords that are there, they're driving back and forth. It's not, I guess what I'm saying is not just people on foot who are there evacuating. Are there other moments for you where you think, is that fabricated? Or is it just the distance, the sheer distance of having to walk a 10 mile round trip?
I think if he walked 5 miles, we'd have heard a lot more about it in his letters. And in the other, in the other journalism, who's to say? The thing that emerges for me about the journalism first is the overlap between what ends up in our time and what was written in the journalism, but also the emotion. I think that he must have been profoundly moved by the atrocity, by the humanity. Mm. And I think real emotion comes out. I think more emotion comes out from this retreat than we're going to see in other scenes of violence and war in our time. So Hemingway's always characterized as dealing with matters of great emotion, sort of matter-of-factly, sort of coldly.
Yeah.
I don't see that. I think in the journalism, he really is appalled by what he sees.
I think to your point, is she completely fictionalized? I don't know, but Madame Marie is a really interesting character, this kind of opportunistic innkeeper. You know, whether it's the Greeks or the Turks or whoever, they're all the same, she says. I've seen them all. They've all had Karagash. Who are the best? Nobody. They're all the same. In essence, they all pay.
And she has a flea-ridden, you know, bug-ridden facility. Yeah. And she's like, hey, what do you want from me? You know?
She's an awesome character in a story. At the same time, to your other point, how much kind of pathos is here, how emotionally rendered this is. Notice what Hemingway says in response to her when she says, they all pay me. He says, but the poor people that are out there in the road, I couldn't get the horror of that 20-mile-long procession out of my mind. Yeah, and so this has, it seems, based on the kind of narrator, the kind of journalist that's being depicted here, it seems like this has really touched him.
Michael, I would add that in the article, A Silent, Ghastly Procession, from October 20th, 1922. The thing that that article has that the sketch lacks is that he starts by talking about the silence of the procession. He says it is a silent procession. Nobody even grunts. He establishes the enormous number of people and the silence of all of these people. And then he has one woman giving birth. The husband is the character, the husband who puts the blanket over. The husband is fictionalized to a young girl because that's better for drama. But here in the article, a husband spreads a blanket over a woman in labor in one of the carts to keep off the driving rain. She is the only person making a sound. Her little daughter looks at her in horror and begins to cry. So that's the scene in the journalism. But of course, in chapter 3, there was a woman having a kid with a young girl holding a blanket over her and crying. One of the interesting things, Michael, not to go on, just want to add to this point, is that in the journalistic treatment of it, Hemingway says, staggering men, women, and children, there are no men in the sketch. The only men are old men. So we have old men, old women, and a woman, and a little girl, and a baby. We don't have the men, is in the article.
We, you know, yeah, exactly. And we have, I guess, some men who we have the men who are
in the cavalry.
Greek cavalry. Would you say that that's the main reason that this functions here? To have no men who are there in the evacuation is now you have that distinction between the men who are there in this army and these just the elderly who are walking and the women and the children.
You were talking about the pathos of it, and I think he heightens the pathos. Not that it isn't emotional enough in the historical reality, but think of the difference between a little girl holding the blanket over the mother versus the husband or a man.
I want to ask you about that. You said, gosh, what word did you use? But it's obvious that it's better, or it's better for fiction that this should be the case. And so I want to ask you why you think that. On the one hand, you're saying it's just much more emotionally wrought to have woman, child, and the child's the one who's there holding the blanket. So there's the other aspect of it that it's just distilled even more,
yeah.
right? That it's just
That's
this right. woman and the child. You don't have three characters here. And so that, you know, that's the other part of it. There was a woman having a kid. And that's an interesting word to use too, right? There was a woman having a kid with a young girl holding a blanket over her and crying. And so we don't have husband, wife, child. Boom. It's just
and
two
we don't,
individuals.
And this is consistent with the first two chapters. We don't have Hemingway or the narrator or the focalizing lens walking 5 miles along with these people the way we do in the article. We don't know mm-hmm. who is observing this.
No, we don't. You know, it's almost like it's not even an individual who's the narrator. It's not even this individual there on the ground. It just says no end and no beginning. And I know you're talking about Hemingway says that he's been walking 5 miles, but it's also this kind of bird's eye. And you almost float up and you almost see this... What does he call it in one of the articles? This
eternal, right?
Eternal procession of humanity,
right?
That you just see it from this, you know, 500 foot, 1,000 foot view, and you can see the stretch of it.
Well, if you could see it from, you know, the proverbial bird's eye mm-hmm. view, that might be the only way you can see the an end or a beginning. But if you're in the belly of the beast, you know what? Do you remember, mm-hmm. Michael, that moment in the Caporetto retreat of A Farewell to Arms when mm-hmm. Frederick thinks, he remembers thinking, this line could stretch all the way to Udine, like where he would have no, absolute, he would only know that in retrospect. So mm-hmm. I think no end and no beginning, which is like you're in a long line. Where it's like, I can't see going that way in front of me, and I can't see mm-hmm. going behind me. I'm in the middle of this mass of people. So maybe he's putting you in there. So no end and no beginning. Like, the sketch doesn't have an end or a beginning, right? He's not saying this is what happened at the, and it's just we're in the middle of it. We're immediate. Mm-hmm. It's the immediacy of the presentation. Goes mm-hmm. along with this endlessness of the march.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a really good point because he brings you down into the detail of it too. So yeah, I wouldn't want to say that it's too far removed. If I'm using the imagery of this kind of bird's eye view, either that's wrong or at least it doesn't stay that way for too long. Because like you're saying, he brings you down into the immediate details of it. And here, and in both of the, well, he actually writes a few different articles about this evacuation. But in this one, this silent, ghastly procession, and even the refugees from Thrace One, it's like the only way that he can capture it is in this listing of the people, the kinds of people, the kinds of things that they're bringing.
The animals.
And like you're saying, that scene of retreat or evacuation in A Farewell to Arms, but that scene of retreat is pretty similar in some of those moments where he just wants to list who's on the road. What are they bringing with them on the road? Them kind of stuck and stalled out there on the road. But he, you know, it's like that stylistic feature of wanting to list the different kinds of things. Women and kids were in the carts crouched with mattresses, mirrors, sewing machines, bundles, right?
I love
miscellaneous,
it.
Yeah. Right? Disconnected.
Sewing machines, the incongruity of needing a sewing machine on the retreat. This episode of One True Podcast is supported by the Hemingway Review, the scholarly journal of the Ernest Hemingway Foundation and Society. Michael and I are excited about the fall 2023 issue with guest editors Ian Marshall and Margaret E. Wright Cleveland, where their theme for this issue is Hemingway in Black and White. It's a fascinating collection of voices tackling a wide range of issues related to Hemingway and race. For this special issue and back issues, please visit HemingwaySociety.org/journals. One True Podcast is proud to announce that this In Our Time episode is sponsored by Simon & Schuster Audio, which provided Stacey Keach's beautiful introduction to today's show. The Simon & Schuster Audio Collection is an absolute treasure. Check out their entire Hemingway collection of audiobooks, including Stacey Keach's epic performance of all of Hemingway's short stories, collected in the unabridged Short Stories Gift Edition. Michael, the entire Hemingway catalog or selected titles are available for download or on CD, including the legendary Donald Sutherland reading The Old Man and the Sea, John Slattery from Mad Men performing A Farewell to Arms, the late William Hurt's brilliant take on The Sun Also Rises, and others.
Absolutely. In fact, I just spent a long car ride across Florida listening to Campbell Scott's reading of For Whom the Bell Tolls, and it was great company.
Visit the Hemingway page at simonandschuster.com to order Hemingway audiobooks from our friends at Simon & Schuster Audio. I think that when we were talking about how Hemingway presents it and who is narrating this, the sentence to me that is the most devastating in the sketch is scared sick looking at it, which is actually a more devastating sentence than I found in any of the journalism pieces. The second to last sentence is scared sick looking at it. Now, do you take that to mean the mother is scared sick, the young girl is scared sick, or the guy who is writing the sketch or narrating the sketch is scared sick looking at it?
I took it to mean the young girl scared sick looking at it. You're making me wonder.
I mean, no subject,
right?
It's
any
a fragment.
Other, oh, no. No. It's a, yeah, it's like this.
Not a sentence. Yeah.
Fragment. And it's, again, one of those moments where because it's not a, technically speaking, it's not a complete sentence, almost like no end and no beginning. It's right. Just this image that you're caught with. And so, yeah, who is the subject of it? And we might also want to ask, what is the it of it? Maybe we'll get there. But you're making me wonder, are there other moments where the narrative voice kind of turns inward and addresses itself? But scared, to me, scared sick.
So you're saying the it can be the girl looking at the birth, or it could be the narrator looking at the entire retreat.
I think it's possible. I lean more towards the girl because I don't know if there are other moments where the narrator is really thinking about their own reflection on that scene. Not that there has to be, but I just read it more as the young girl.
I don't know if this,
you?
Michael, I don't know if this adds to your point, but we remember that in 1925, chapter 3 turns into chapter 2. Which comes right after Indian Camp.
Mm-hmm.
And the great moment in Indian Camp is Nick Adams as a young boy having to decide whether or not to look at a very difficult impromptu childbirth. So this sort of parallels that or echoes it in a really powerful way. So I think that would probably lend credence to that reading.
Yeah, the fact that in Indian Camp, what is it? His dad is trying to explain what labor is, and Nick says, "I see."
Right?
No, you don't. But you know, it's such a beautiful story that captures his youthfulness. And then, like you're saying, after the birth, and his father's finishing up with the procedure, and the moment, one of the moments that you're talking about, he was looking away so as not to see what his father was doing. He's trying to look away. It is loaded, and we might want to say for listeners that if you want more of a discussion on how it functions in Hemingway, Ross Tangadol gives a really good discussion in one of our other episodes on 3 Stories and 10 Poems. So please check that out. But in part because of the fact that Nick is looking away, it is a pretty loaded word that object that is undefined or ill-defined there. And so here, if it is the girl, what is it? Is it what's actually happening with the childbirth itself? Is it the evacuation? Is it, what is it? And is it, of course, more powerful because it's not so defined?
I think that's a great point. Scared, sick, looking at it could be the kid at having been born. And then that incredible use of it, the word that comes after it is it, right? It reigned all through the evacuation. When, now going back to what we were saying earlier about Hemingway as a kind of a understated iceberg theory, unemotional figure, that last sentence, like scared, sick, looking at it, is like drenched with that kind of human emotion. And then it reigned all through the evacuation. Now we go back to an objective closer with that sentence. This sketch has 13 sentences. Sentence one has the rain, and sentence 13 has the rain. We have some mud in between, but it's really, it's not like the Caporetto retreat where in the rain is like every fourth sentence he puts that phrase in there. Minarets stuck up in the rain out of Adrianople, across that, like those, that profusion of prepositions.
Can I ask real quick, as we're getting to how it bookends, and this is to linger a little bit longer on that second to last sentence. So here it is in A Silent Ghastly Procession. I know the husband's gone now, but in Silent Ghastly Procession, he's there. But here's that sentence. She is the only person making a sound, and here it comes. Her little daughter looks at her in horror and begins to cry. So I know we've been talking about it for a while, but why not, instead of scared sick, why is that better than her daughter looks at her in horror or crying looking at it? What does scared sick do that those other words are not doing? Why is it better
I thought about that. To me, look in horror, it's more vague than scared sick. I know that neither of them are actually describing the face the way it actually looks. Scared sick, to me, it's like that, those two monosyllables. It's like a punch. So I can feel scared sick, even if I can't see it. But looked in horror, I think I've heard before, probably a little general. Am I just trying to justify Hemingway's decision? What do you think?
Yeah, I can feel that sickness. At the same time, I don't know what it actually means. Is she becoming sick? Right? We have the kid, the bullfighter in the last vignette who's actually becoming sick, right? In the sand there. Is she becoming sick in that way? Is she scared sick in a very different way? Because now what's happening to this woman having this kid? Is it her mom? We imagine. But now what's happening to this family? What are they going to do in this evacuation? Right? Are there doctors around? Are they going to be able to seek any kind of medical attention? We know with Hemingway that childbirth is always not just tinged with danger. Right? There's something potentially imminent about it. And so is she thinking about that? Like, what are we going to be able to do now when there are hundreds of thousands of other people around us and they're not thinking about us?
It's a great question. And I think you bring up a great point about childbirth, because remember the moment in On Writing, which is the discarded addendum or the original ending to Big Too Hard River we talked about with James Plath, where we have a bit of metafiction where Hemingway, writing as from the perspective of Nick Adams, he says, of course Nick didn't see a Native American woman having it was that time in Carrigatch. So this actually, he takes this and he personalizes it. He makes it that autobiographical presentation in Indian Camp. It's fascinating, this appropriation, right?
Yeah.
And then he's still writing about it in the snows of Kilimanjaro, right? This must have been, as Heraclea said it, it must have been a really affecting experience, even though it was like a month or so, right? It was no more than a month.
Yeah. There's a moment in Refugees from Thrace, and I know you have questions about like why there's about the rain and about the beginning and the ending, but there's this moment in Refugees from Thrace where he says, I have described that evacuation in a cable to the star from Adrianople. It does no good to go over it again. And yet that's at the beginning of this article, and he's going to go over it again for pages, and he's going to go over it again in the vignette, and he's going to go over it again, as you're saying, in another story, and he's going to go over it again in that excised part of Big Darted River. He's going to keep going over it. So yeah, to that point, this is one of those wars and evacuations that doesn't get as much attention as it deserves. There's rain. It rained all through the evacuation. That's not how that original one ended. And I know we don't have to do a comparative study all the way through, but Silent Ghastly Procession doesn't end in rain. That moment ends and the procession keeps moving. Like right after they're focused on that kind of triad of husband, wife, child, it's the procession keeps moving, which in itself is devastating. That this is happening and people can't, there's no way for people to actually do anything about this family here. They have to keep moving, no matter what they might want to do. But with Hemingway, of course, rain is more than just rain. It rained all through the evacuation. So like, why is, and we have that other moment there where the water is flooding, right? The Maritsa was running yellow. What a great image. Running yellow almost up to the bridge. So water, rain. In a really short vignette, why is he taking that time and space to focus on water and rain in that way? What does it do?
So in Refugees from Thrace, he says the drizzling rain. We don't want to talk about it being drizzling in a work of fiction, right? We want to emphasize the rain. So he's talking about the rain, the mud, the enormity of the procession, but also the specificity of this one little family, this one little girl, and ultimately a baby. It rained during Catherine's child delivery too, in A Farewell to Arms. So that's his motif. It's perfect.
I don't know why I keep coming back to different kinds of artwork here as a way to understand what Hemingway's doing. I think it's maybe because he's thinking about silence so much, and yet he's thinking about the movement. And I'm thinking about the way that he's using lists to focus on discrete, kind of concrete objects. He's also using fragments to focus on these images. So to me, you mix that with the silence. These are like photographs, but also because it's this procession, it's kind of like film. It's kind of like a silent film. And he's so interested in film and these newsreel makers in the Refugees from Thrace. So I can't get away from how this kind of relates to photography and film in some way. So I'm thinking that first moment in Silent Ghastly Procession, it's like this camera eye is lingering on this family and it's turning away, right? So it's turning away to see this procession moving. But here you have it staying with them and then the rain's coming down and then it just fades to black and that's it. Like that's the last image that you see. So you go from this big group, and whether it's shot from above bird's eye, and maybe, you know what, after 10 or 15 minutes of thinking about it in the back of my mind, I'm entirely wrong. I think it is like down in there with everybody, like you're talking about. I don't know if it is from above at all. I think you're instantaneously in that moment right there with the evacuees. But it goes from like this multitude down to one
that's
image of, and so distilled, and then it leaves. And it leaves you there with them. It doesn't turn away from them. It's a very different tactic.
If you're watching the minarets be tall, you're down there. And we start with out of Adrianople, like across the mudflats. We have a broad panoramic shot. And then we go, and then we narrow in. I also like how we go from the carts were jammed to carts were jammed solid on the bridge. Greek cavalry herded along the procession. What about that? With sort of men or human beings and animals are indistinguishable. You have cattle in the procession, but it's the people who are getting herded along. It's just a mess.
Yeah, it reminds me of the image that he'll use just in a more overt way. And one of the pieces where he talks about the cavalry, I think, are the cowpunchers, and the people are the cattle. And it's like, therefore, it's got this kind of Western, you know, you're on the you're in the American West, right? And it's this, yeah, cowpunchers and cattle, that they're steer, that they are being directed on there. You were talking about the minarets earlier, and this brings us into Turkey, into the Muslim world itself. Why start, if we start there, if he starts there with that being the first word, does that change anything for us if it's there and then we get to the Greeks and the Greek cavalry after? Is it different if we start with the Greeks? Is he doing something important or intentional with the minarets being the first image that we have?
I think your question is excellent. It's such a curious choice.
Mm-hmm.
Why we need that sentence, except to establish the setting, right? He talks about minarets. He seems to fix on minarets in the journalism too, doesn't he?
He does, yeah. And there's a different, what is it, old Constant. He's talking about Constantinople, and he talks about not just the minarets, but they're there. And he refers to this as part of the, correct me if I'm wrong, but like the magic of the East. And he'll never get down specifically to defining what it is. It reminds me sometimes of how he kind of talks about the aura of Cuba, like what Cuba is about for him. And he just starts listing some things, but the magic of the East is kind of tied to these images, and the minarets are part of that.
Signal that this is a religious war. Yeah. And so in Old Constant, in that journalism piece, he starts with the minarets and the call to prayer. And the second paragraph is talking about coming down with bed bugs and malaria and all that. It must have been just a miserable experience. Apparently, he had to shave his hair when he got back to Paris. Is that true?
I've of course seen pictures of him in the
Africa,
50s, right? when he shaved his head. But like, I have not seen any pictures of him in Paris. Have you? Are there pictures of him at that point in Paris with his head shaved?
I don't remember seeing one. You can see why he wouldn't have spent chapter 3 talking about having lice, because it's not about his inconvenience or this Western journalist coming and complaining about it, although that is certainly a theme of the letters and some of the journalism. So I wanted to pick up on, Michael, on another thing you were talking about, which is one of the most riveting parts of it, which is the way Hemingway lists objects. In Refugees from Thrace, you have this incredible sequence: dodging camels that swayed and grunted along past flat-wheeled ox carts piled high with bedding, mirrors, furniture, pigs tied flat, mothers huddled under blankets with their babies, old men and women leaning on the back of the buffalo carts and just keeping their feet moving, their eyes on the road and their heads sunken. I think that's really vivid reporting.
It is. You know, you get a sense from all the detail, the realism of it. You also get this sense of the desperation. Like, if I'm not coming back, what do I bring? Yeah. What can I bring? How much time do I have?
Yeah.
And certainly in A Farewell to Arms, there's that discussion too. And at the same time, you have that disparity, sewing machines and children, in this case, sewing machines and children. And we have almost this unstated contrast between, you know, what things do you take in the moment in the rush of trying to get your everything you own, what you can, together, and the most valuable of those things, and trying to make those decisions.
Can we make any connection between chapter 3 and Caporetto? Only saying that because Caporetto has got to be one of the 3 or 4 most celebrated passages that Hemingway ever wrote, that chapter in A Farewell to Arms. Do you see any, is there any time that you're reminded of his treatment of Caporetto during this sketch?
We've talked about some of it, and that's just the, what can become so symbolic throughout A Farewell to Arms. And that's the rain, the bridges, these kinds of scenes of this, the kinds of setting, the climate. If we're starting there, they show up here. They certainly resonate there.
That's excellent. What about when Frederick and his friends meet the two virgins, those sisters, and they're so scared. Of course, they have every right to be scared, particularly the way Frederick and Imo are so kind of callous.
Yeah, the conversation, yeah.
Yeah, right. And it's very bawdy. That young girl, I think the young girl in chapter 3 reminds me of the young girl in the Caporetto retreat. And Caporetto, hundreds of thousands of people moving across country, but Hemingway focuses on one innocent, scared, very, very vulnerable character.
Yeah. And there's that image of the girls, they're receiving some money, like he's giving them a little bit of money and kind of sending them back, and little moments that capture the real brutality of the situation, of that wartime situation, which could not have been done if what you're trying to do is focus too generally on the entire war. You have to focus in. I mean, at least Hemingway's thinking that's the technique to use, right? If there is no end and no beginning, it is this eternal procession of humanity. You can't capture that by trying to write that entire thing. You have to focus it down in kind of a counterintuitive way on one or two characters, maybe at a time.
Mm-hmm. I kind of think of Walt Whitman's Song of Myself, how he captures or tries to capture all of America one person at a time, but he's using one figure. He's confident enough to pick one character and describe that person in one sentence. And then he'll find another one. And then, of course, he accumulates all of these characters. Of course, you can't talk about every single person in America, but if you produce the details and render it successfully, it'll come alive. And it'll actually, I think of that kind of specificity. Whitman does it so beautifully in Song of Myself. And here he does the same.
I was going to ask, Frederick Henry has a certain perspective on the army, the officers in Farewell to Arms, right? Do you think there's a similar kind of vantage point on the Greek cavalry or the Turkish forces? Is there anything here where you could say Hemingway is thinking from a similar mindset about war, about military, about the different kinds of levels of military service, officers versus enlisted? Is that not here?
I think this is a pretty objective piece of writing. I don't think he is leaning one way or the other politically. It's an objective piece of writing, but it's not unemotional or unhuman. I think you can be objective while still recognizing the humanity. So, I mean, the word herded is probably a recognition of how horrible the situation is. That's how I read. Do you think he's tipping his hand one way or the other?
No, I don't. And I think there are moments in the journalism where he will be even-handed in the sense that he seems critical. There's this, is it a Greek soldier? Maybe, again, someone who's part of the Greek cavalry who's trying to use his language, herd people to one side. And he's intentionally going to push this Turkish driver to the other side. And it leads to this argument, to some physical violence. And yet at the same time, the way he describes the Turkish forces, or at one point he describes them as the Turk. You know, it's really interesting how he will characterize both sides. But I do not think that he's leaning to one side or the other. He seems critical of both, trying to be objective about both.
You would feel for this woman delivering a baby, no matter what nationality she was. And we get that in On the Quay at Smyrna too, right? I also would like to add that in Milton A. Cohen's great book, Hemingway's Laboratory, and again, we hope to have Milt on a little bit later this year, he points out that when Hemingway first wrote this chapter, he wrote it from the perspective of the woman. If that were the case, it would have thrown off this whole posture of objectivity that we have been noticing that how Hemingway has established it. But it is interesting. He tried it from that perspective, but went right back to this kind of more journalistic presentation.
Isn't that remarkable, though, that Hemingway would try that? It makes me think Indian Camp potentially being written from the perspective of this, you know, this Native American woman in labor, right? But that can be Hemingway's mindset at times, where we think, or we might think, that he is trying to remain objective in a way that pulls him completely away from those kinds of character points of view.
Two more pieces of language that I wanted to run by you that I'd feel remorseful if we didn't tackle. We talked about the two sentences that seem like almost like they're twin sentences, no end and no beginning, and scared sick looking at it, which are really powerful, even though they are fragments. And I think one of the reasons why they are so powerful is look at the pattern that he establishes in all the other sentences, or just about all the other sentences. So we have them in the rain, out of Adrianople, across the mud flats, along the Karagatch Road, through the mud, walked along, keeping the cattle moving, up to the bridge. We have all these prepositional phrases. And it's almost like that becomes the defining feature of just about every sentence in this, except, or most notably, no end and no beginning, and scared sick looking at it, which like disrupt that kind of descriptive pattern. And then he goes right back to it. It rained all through the evacuation. So that's really kind of an intricate pattern that he's establishing there.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking of these prepositions that are working. And the prepositions also seem to suggest the movement that's taking place, right? Along, keeping the cattle moving, along through them, right? Heard it along the procession. But at the same time, sentence four, in the second to last, no end and no beginning, scared sick looking at it. What those do for me, because they break that structure of not only having complete sentences, but having these sentences with those kinds of other phrases that are, to me, more movement-oriented phrases, as I'm stuck for a second or two. I'm like waiting for the sentence to be completed, or I'm trying to make sense of it. I certainly can make more sense of no end and no beginning.
Yeah, right,
my mind around the concept, scared sick looking at it. There's so much to that that we wonder what it itself is. And then, like you said, the it afterwards is, you fumble with that.
And just
of that
like
repetition.
We talked about in previous episodes, look at the way he changes the subject as the sketch. So it's minarets stuck up in the rain. So minarets is the subject of the first sentence. And then the carts were jammed for 30 miles. So then the carts is the subject of the second. Water buffalo and cattle, that's the subject of the third sentence. So think about that, right? Minarets, carts, and then water buffalo and cattle. And the fourth sentence is no end and no beginning. So we have no subject of that sentence. And we're waiting for like, who are we? Who are the people? Who are the characters that are going to populate this? Old women and women, old men and women. Hemingway is sort of establishing this kind of style of sort of scanning through this busy scene.
I didn't pay attention to it, but right after no end, no beginning, just carts loaded with everything.
And how does he know everything they owned? So who is inferring that is everything that they owned?
Yeah, and that listing helps to suggest it, right? But how do you know, placed on this cart, right?
It actually picks up the first paragraph of A Silent Ghastly Procession, that article where that first paragraph ends, staggering men, women, and children, blankets over their heads, walking blindly along in the rain beside their worldly goods. And I thought that was a really affecting worldly goods, putting it right there. And even the headline, and I don't know if Hemingway came up with the headline, A Silent Ghastly Procession. And he talks about a ghastly procession in that cowpuncher's phrase that you were talking about.
He certainly is interested in silence and what's not silent. So just like he's interested in this kind of sweeping, breathtaking image that he tries to distill into one, three characters, right? This one family. And here in this vignette, it's this endless procession that he's distilling down into these two characters. At the same time that that's happening in that piece that you're talking about, yeah, it's silence that's broken with just this one character making noise. Sounds important, of course, as well.
I want to observe that we start chapter one on the way to war. We start in chapter three is retreating or evacuating from war. Chapter two is this insane bullfighting scene. So, you know, we haven't seen like bullets winging by. It's the emotion, the exhaustion, the fear, the absurdity. I am likewise, I am amazed at how Hemingway is accumulating all of this together. And wouldn't you know it, Michael, for chapter four, we're going to head right back to World War One. You ready? You ready to do it?
Awesome. Okay.
Always nice talking to Michael. Thanks for joining.
Thank you.
And thanks to you all for listening in. This episode and past episodes are available at onetruepod.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Our book, One True Sentence, Writers and Readers on Hemingway's Art, is available anywhere books are sold, so we encourage you to pick up a copy or two and enjoy more Hemingway talk. You can also support this podcast by leaving us a rating and telling your friends all about us. Feel free to write us at onetruepod@gmail.com. That's the number one, truepod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. This episode and all In Our Time episodes are made possible by a generous grant from Indiana Humanities in cooperation with the National Endowment for the Humanities. This show is also supported by the Hemingway Society and Florida Gulf Coast University. Join us next time as we continue exploring Hemingway, his life, his work, and his world. Until then, I'm Mark Chirino with Michael Von Cannon, and this is One True Podcast.